You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of April 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Sweden has been attacked. Everything indicates that this is a terror attack.
At least three people killed in Stockholm as a truck is deliberately driven at pedestrians. We'll have the latest from Stockholm and discussion from my guests Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Steve Bloomfield of that and the day's other big stories, including...
Tonight I ordered a targeted military strike on the airfield in Syria from where the chemical attack was launched.
The US acts directly against the Syrian regime for the first time. Later in the show, we'll have a reflection on this year's Salone del Mobile, and we'll be wondering why the idea of connecting a great city with its international airport by rail is proving so obstinately controversial in Melbourne. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, and Monocle's executive editor, Steve Bloomfield. Welcome all. We will start tonight in Stockholm, where at least three people have been killed and several injured in what appears to have been a deliberate attack with a lorry. The truck, reported hijacked earlier this morning, drove along the pedestrian arcade Drottninggatan before crashing into the Ahlens department store. It is the latest in a series of similar incidents around Europe in recent months. We're also joined now by Elna Andersson, our Stockholm correspondent. Elna, if we come to you first, what is the latest?
Well, the latest, the police has just had a press conference and they've shown a picture of a man that they're looking for that might have something to do with this these events. And they didn't actually confirm the number of deaths or injured, just because the hospital hasn't confirmed that yet. But as you're saying, most sources are saying three dead and eight injured.
Just to come back to you, Elna, despite earlier reports, then no arrests have been made?
No arrests. The central Stockholm is basically shut down at the moment. Every sort of communications have been shut down, the tube and the buses and so on. But what you're seeing is a lot of police looking for the persons who did this.
And what else is happening in Stockholm now? If everything is closed, how are people reacting? Are people still out on the streets, or has everyone gone home for the evening?
Yes, people are trying to get home because obviously the only way to get home is taxi or walk. And so you see masses of people, you know, trying to get home and walking. And I would say that people are quite shocked. We're not used to this in Stockholm, as maybe, you know, unfortunately, people are in some other cities. But we really haven't had these types of attacks here. So the people I've seen and talked to are kind of reacting with disbelief and, you know, sadness.
I want to come now to Andrew Tuck, Monocle's editor here in the studio. We heard at the top of the show, Andrew, a clip from the Swedish Prime Minister, Stefan Löfven, who said that everything points to a terrorist attack. This is something I wondered about a couple of weeks ago when we had something similar happen here in London. When we call something terrorism now, do we still mean what we meant by that 15 or 20 years ago?
Well, I think terrorism is striking terror into people, and that's the very nature of it. It doesn't matter what you use. This isn't like the terrorism where we see the IRA bombs that used to happen here in London. But it is terror in the sense that it changes people's behaviour, and it changes people's feeling about the city they live in, and it changes the relationship to the people they see next to them on the subways. That is terrorism. It re-engineers your world and your city through terror. So I think that is definitely terrorism. But I think here we have to be cautious again and wait to see who this guy is and what he was doing. But the other strange thing is, isn't it, just this psychological thing of being a copycat, you know, that you get one of these attacks, people see it successful, they've been waiting to see what they could do, and they suddenly realise, unfortunately, they literally just need a truck. And all of these are copycats. It's not that they're working together, or they're not in cahoots with each other. It's literally that they are copying what they've seen as getting headlines around the world.
Steve Bloomfield, without wishing to sort of lapse into nostalgia for the terrorism of, for example, the IRA, which Andrew mentioned, is there a disconnect there, though? Because the IRA and similar organisations around that time at least had what was an ideology and a political agenda, which, whether you agreed with it or not, it was coherent, it was plausible, and it was arguable. Whereas there does seem to be, about this and similar attacks we've seen in Europe in recent months, this sort of absolutely terrible empty nihilism. There doesn't appear to be any discernible point at all.
No, but I think the change happened earlier. That change happened from September 11th, 2001. As you say, the IRA attacks on the British mainland in the 70s, 80s and 90s in the UK, there was a political agenda behind it, whether you agreed with it or not, and it ended up being negotiations and a peace deal. What Al-Qaeda wanted, what then ISIS have since wanted since then, is not something that you can negotiate over, and in many ways now is not entirely clear what is wanted, other than to sow chaos and terror. In terms of this attack and how it happened and the similarities with the other attacks that we've seen over the past 18, 24 months, when you had, there are sort of two main ways to try and prevent terror attacks. One is through intelligence, and obviously that is still going on. But the other is in terms of taking preventative measures. Now, after September the 11th, improvements were made to airport security and to aeroplane security. After the attempted tube bombing on airplane, again, we all had to take off our shoes. After the attempted liquid bombing, we all had to put in liquid. You could do that on airports. You could do that on aeroplanes and at certain key points. You cannot have security measures which stop someone in a truck driving off the road. You cannot have security measures that stop someone going into a venue like the Bataclan or into any restaurant anywhere in town and shooting people. You cannot do that if you still want to be an open society. And that's the great challenge that we have to deal with right now.
Tyler Brulé, to bring you in, we did talk in a recent issue of Monocle magazine about certain defensive measures that have been taken in cities, especially in London, against the idea of vehicle-borne attacks. But I think most of those measures were installed with the idea that the vehicle would be carrying a bomb or an explosive, not that the idea that the vehicle itself was the weapon. Is there actually anything that city planners and city authorities can or indeed should do if this is to become the new weapon of choice for jihadis, if that is indeed what we're dealing with?
Yeah, I think it's very difficult, Andrew, for a variety of reasons. And it goes back to what Steve is saying, echoing Andrew a little bit as well, which is we're talking about the foundations of liberal democracy, which is about an open society. So, you know, are there probably measures to say that, okay, these are high footfall areas for tourists and or for just ordinary residents of a city where people are already looking at, you know, can we put in barricades? So in the case of course, the recent attack in London, that a small SUV cannot mount a sidewalk and then mow people down. And I'm sure these are discussions which are happening, but this is not, you know, if these things happen, then I don't want to go back to the line that the terrorists win, but it is part of it. And suddenly you have another impediment to your day that simply wasn't there before. And of course, where does it end? So a roundabout answer, I don't think there is much that can be done. I think it has to be reactive. And, you know, there's, you know, similarly, we've had the discussion in Berlin. Now the discussion, of course, in Stockholm, looking at the, you know, various newspapers, and of course a lot of comment that is coming out of Stockholm right now. Will Stockholm move into London territory, U.S. territory, where there will be a lot of CCTV? And we know that obviously this has been a big discussion off the back of Berlin, something that, you know, Germans, you know, do not like this style of surveillance, and of course measures have been taken since Christmas to address this, and I'm sure there's going to be a big discussion about this in Sweden, but it's largely reactive. I don't think there's much you can do to wreck things. Of course, there is a much bigger issue, which of course goes, you get into a larger discussion about education and integration and all of these things, but I think that's a very, very tough discussion to have, whether it's with Germany, Sweden, France, or anywhere else.
Just quickly, Tyler, it was interesting earlier in the year when we saw, Donald Trump, wrongly suggest that there'd been a terrorist attack the previous night in Sweden, and Swedes were up in arms, kind of almost they were laughing at him, saying it's ridiculous. That kind of thing doesn't happen here. I wonder, you know Sweden very well, do you think that there is a bit of a discussion that doesn't happen in Sweden? Because I think many people think that integration has been so successful and there's nothing to worry about, we're all nice liberal Democrats, that perhaps some of the tougher questions about these small element, but these Islamist hate preachers and the people who end up taking these attacks are not being questioned, are not being pulled in, and are not being found early enough.
I think there are two Swedens, Andrew. Absolutely, you've hit it on the head. I think there's many people that you can talk to who live not very far away from Drottninggatan, who probably go to the grocery store in the basement of Åhléns, who represent one part of Swedish society. And despite the numbers of people that Sweden takes in, integration is a huge issue, and I think that Sweden has been celebrated, and they've made an enormous reputation for themselves because they've been so welcoming. But we've seen so many stories. There was a very good story in the New Yorker last week about this apathy disease that people have because they've been living in limbo. We're talking about asylum seekers and the fact that they see that they can't go on, and people who've even been living in Sweden who are of course on the path to citizenship are just not woven in. They're not part of Swedish society. So I think that you absolutely have the case of two Swedens. I think also your point about, of course, people sort of ridiculing Donald Trump and people, of course, lived off this for many, many weeks. There is a second discussion to be had. And I was reading something from a counterterrorism expert a little bit earlier, just saying that it could be a situation that Sweden, for legal reasons, also from, and which also goes to intelligence gathering, is in a place not unlike London, probably in the mid-1990s, when of course, various legislation change that you were able to go in and kick in the front doors of people who were seen to be funding terrorist organizations, etc. And there are a number of statutes which do not exist on the Swedish books at the moment that allows just the same type of intelligence gathering.
Okay, we'll have more on that story on tonight's Daily. Let's look now, though, at today's other bigger story, which is last night's missile strike by the United States on the Shayrat airbase in Syria. It was far from the first American air raid on Syrian soil in recent years, but it was the first deliberate targeting of assets associated with the regime of President Bashar al-Assad. 59 Tomahawk missiles were launched from U.S. warships in the Mediterranean in the early hours of this morning. Russia and Iran condemned the raid. U.S. allies, including Turkey, supported it. Steve, first of all, the US, we are told, informed Russia in advance, which was a fairly wise move, given that you probably don't want 59 cruise missiles and Russian aircraft in the same airspace at the same time. The Russians presumably informed Syria, so presumably these 59 Tomahawks have demolished a bunch of empty buildings. Is that still a statement worth making?
Possibly. I think any military action in Syria has to be part of a broader strategy that includes how do you try to demolish President Assad's regime's attempt to kill its own citizens from the air. And there's been a lot of talk over the last 5 or 6 years about introducing a no-fly zone and what that would do. And it's something that we've spoken about before. And I think many of us around this table have at times been broadly supportive of that. But on its own, one has to wonder what this does. And my biggest concern, to be honest, is how this decision was made. Let's not forget that Donald Trump was deeply critical of Barack Obama when Obama was thinking of doing something similar 4 years ago. During the election campaign just a few short months ago, he was talking about the dangers of America getting involved in Syria, how they shouldn't get involved in Syria, how if you voted for Hillary Clinton, she would bomb Syria and that would be a disaster. He has talked about the importance of, indeed of saying, we're no longer in favour of getting rid of Assad. And then he saw this 2 days ago and changed his mind and started bombing. You know, I struggle with this idea that we have a president who sees something on TV and says, right, I've changed my mind, I'm going to bomb.
Tyler, does it strike you that it has been that impulsive as well? Or are you in that kind of coterie of optimists who suspect that we are about to be blessed with some incredibly well thought through and coherent plan for the way forward?
No, I think this is a bit of a knee-jerk down in Mar-a-Lago, sadly. And I think it's doing two things, Andrew. You know, first, it's slightly coming good on this promise and also the, you know, really the rhetoric that we saw during the election campaign, where you had Trump saying, well, I don't understand, you know, the last administrations before, where we had Obama sort of, you know, laying out a plan, talking about a timetable of when he was going to attack. So I think part of this was, well, look at, and maybe there was a discussion. I have a feeling there wasn't a very long one. But if I don't like what I see, I'm going to take action. And if it was well thought through, then we have to sort of wonder what comes next. I think the other side of it, though, and Steve, I'm interested in your point of view, is also just, yes, the strike was on Syria, but it's not just a question of, is Syria on watch? Are other places on watch as well? And really sort of showing, look at how we behave. We're not going to call you in advance. There's not going to be any classic diplomacy. We're just going to launch a bunch of tomahawks at you.
Well, indeed. In fact, actually, that's what the interesting points, Tyler, is that's the one thing that is consistent here with what Trump said in the past, which is that he will be volatile and unpredictable, and that it's about time that America is like that, and that might lead America's enemies or countries that don't perhaps like it quite so much to be concerned. I think certainly, you know, Vladimir Putin sitting in the Kremlin is probably today a little less sure of what Donald Trump thinks and what he's going to do. And I'm sure, you know, given where Donald Trump is right now, meeting with Xi Jinping and discussing North Korea, he will hope that this has been watched in Pyongyang as well. And Kim Jong-un might think, okay, well, this guy is a bit more unpredictable. It's a really horribly dangerous strategy, if strategy is the right word, but there is that aspect of it too.
I was going to say, for Mr. Trump, it has a couple of other benefits as well. You know, all this inquiry that's going on into the Russia links, suddenly he doesn't seem to be kind of bending to the will of the Russians whatsoever. And after a series of absolutely disastrous defeats, whether that's on the Muslim ban or whether it's on all sorts of other things, suddenly he's got a victory.
It's interesting you say about Russia, Andrew, because I think one of the things that's striking about this is that despite all the allegations and quite a lot of evidence that Vladimir Putin wanted Donald Trump to win and did his best to help him, he hasn't actually got what he wanted out of that. He doesn't have an American president who wants to do a grand deal or is able to do a grand deal with Putin. He doesn't have an American president who's going to let him get away with whatever he wants to get away with in Ukraine and Syria. As Andrew points out now, he's got an American president who is seen as being so closely tied to Putin in the past that he has to act strongly towards him.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Steve Bloomfield. Coming up next, some reflections on this year's Salone de Mobile in Milan.
The Big Interview, the show that brings you the fascinating life stories of some of the most influential people in the world of art and culture, business and politics, continues this week with Isabel Allende.
I think that through writing, I exorcise my obsessions, my demons, my grief.
The Chilean author sits down with me, Ed Stocker, to discuss writing as therapy, the art of storytelling, US politics, and her commitment to human rights, alongside her deep-rooted connections to Latin America.
I live in English, really, but I think in Spanish. I would feel ridiculous making love in English.
The big interview with Isabel Allende premieres this Sunday at 9 a.m. London time on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Steve Bloomfield. Tyler Brulé has been attending Salone de Mobile, as has Andrew Tuck. Now in its 56th year, it is the world's preeminent annual expo of furniture and design. It was this year expecting more than 300,000 visitors. Tyler, among those 300,000 were people attending a 10th anniversary party for Monocle. How did the Milan branch of the celebrations play out?
I think they played it very, very well, and you have to maybe look at the rings under Andrew's eyes, maybe.
and the depth of my voice as well.
The depth of my voice as well. But no, it was, if we just shone a spotlight on our event yesterday, there was probably another 10 editors and commercial colleagues in Milan for a really fantastic event, which brought together our subscribers, our commercial partners, journalists, and of course just a lot of brands that we like. And there was, I guess, you know, on one side, you know, and of course we talk about the fair every year, Andrew, but I think the discussion you know, between me and Mr. Tuck, and I think many other people, is actually the brand Milan discussion. And it was interesting, probably the very seats that you're sitting last week, I was talking to Penny Martin on the stack, and of course we were supposed to be talking about fine print, and we ended up just talking about Milan. She had just come from, of course, the women's shows that were there, and was talking about the energy that the city has. And Andrew, I don't know about you, that's Andrew Tuck, but I really think that there is something going on. And part of it is, we said, you know, is it this afterglow, an afterglow that has worked after an expo, a city that is spent right? It didn't just build monuments and overbrand itself, but there was really an investment in infrastructure. But suddenly this feels like a much more international city.
I think that's definitely true. The expo, you know, 2 years on, they say that another 100,000 jobs were created by that. But more importantly, it changed the attitude of the Milanese. They were unsure about the event in the run-up to it. Then they saw all the world coming to their city, and they'd done lots of good preparations for it. And the legacy of that is a genuine one, unlike many sporting events. It's been a real shift in people's attitudes. But the amazing thing about Salone, I think if you're outside and you think, oh, a furniture fair, there's a few people showing a few chairs. We should understand why it's significant. It's tens of thousands of jobs in furniture. The furniture is going on to yachts being made in the shipyards of La Spezia. The fabric being used on the chairs is being made in Biella. All of these towns and cities all across Italy are glued into this amazing industry, which is a reflection of the times we live in, our tastes, our desires, what's happening in architecture. It's an amazing snapshot of the world. But more importantly, you just realize Italians still make stuff in a way that most other industrial countries don't.
Tyler, I've got a question for you about what this fair says about the state of Italy itself, because, you know, we've got a piece coming out in the new issue about the state of the nation of Italy, and one of the things, without giving too much away about it, it was striking was how that even when Italy's politics and were somewhat precarious, there were huge strengths in the economy, which seemed to sail on regardless.
You're absolutely right, Steve. And, you know, Andrew's touching on that as well. And maybe it's part of it is being in Lombardia, and you're really at the engine of, or the heart of the engine of the country in so many ways. So yes, there is the side of Italy, and you can even be down in Calabria, and yeah, of course having a very good time, and everything sort of functions despite everything that's going wrong at a municipal level, or of course at a national level, in Rome. And this is, you know, this is one of the remarkable things that this country, you know, continues to motor on despite itself. But I think going back to Rome, this is you're now seeing whether it is the bureaucrats who are seizing an opportunity, but thinking and if we really do have an opportunity, design is one of them. This is the most important trade fair in the country. So I would, you know, you'd venture to say it's probably one of the most important trade fairs in Europe in terms of just the sheer amount of revenue that is generated at a very, very local level, restaurants, hotels, shops, etc., across the course course of, you know, the 1 week lead up and then for the fair itself. But then, as Andrew is saying, you know, the connection, of course, to the, you know, Italia Incorporated when it comes to design within its own borders. You know, and then you talk to a lot of people. I mean, you also see how important Italy is for Romania now, how important Italy is for Poland, for Slovenia. This is really, you know, the manufacturing hinterland in both for premium brands, but for a lot of other mid-level players as well. And that's when you really sort of recognize that not just this industry, but I think also there is, as I said, there's really a real understanding that this is something that that the country should be capitalizing on right now. And it seems that somewhere in the halls of bureaucracy that that memo got through.
Okay, well, finally tonight to Melbourne. And if you have ever actually gone to Melbourne, at least by air, then you are by definition among those baffled that a great city and a wealthy country has no rail link with its own international airport. Australia's Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull is now attempting to take the initiative on rectifying this, but Victoria's state government insists that priority should go to regional rail projects readier to leave the drawing board. Tyler, first of all, I have spent a lot of time in taxis and in my dad's car going back and forth to that airport, pondering on the lunacy of this. So I'm possibly somewhat biased, but from a more objective perspective, perhaps, how constricted is Melbourne by this? How big a deal is it?
I think it's considerable. And just in the setup, you're absolutely right. Here is a city which consistently ranks in, if it's not in the top 10, you know, depending on whose ranking it is, it's in the top 5. You know, most livable cities in the world, and one would think that an air rail link, you know, is the 21st century of really sort of arriving and making your mark as a developed urban enclave civilization, what have you. So it is quite remarkable. But at the same time, I can say, you know, if we jump up to Sydney, which yeah, they have a link. There is rolling
it's not,
stock.
It's not bad, in fairness.
It's not, but it's not great.
It's not great
either. I mean, I don't think it is something which people would look up to and say, well, if I was going to benchmark, am I going to go in Sydney to look at that? So I think it is a problem. And you're right. It's a pain going, you know, coming from Tullamarine, heading into the city. And again, for a place where you would think it could function much, much better, it does not. And, you know, and again, these are markers, you know, like anywhere at a time when cities and states and, of course, you know, governments at a federal level want investment, you know, having yeah, an air rail link is also a marker of infrastructure, but also of broader intention.
Andrew Tuck, is it the kind of thing that a city of Melbourne's stature should be moving heaven and earth to get done, or indeed should have moved heaven and earth to get it done about 30 years ago?
Definitely. I think you look at New York, for example. Here again, you arrive at JFK, it's a nightmare getting into the city, and often when you leave,
Tullamarine's not as awful an airport as JFK. In fairness,
Newark is not that bad an airport, but again, the rail link is terrible. Then you get, you know, tossed out in Penn Station, which is another nightmare. Those things affect your impression of coming and going from New York, and I think for frequent travellers, definitely make them think, oh my God, I can't face sitting in a cab on the Van Wyck Highway yet again. What can I do about this? And I think that's the important thing. What's the first impression that people have of your city? Is it efficient? Can you get to downtown? And when you're attracting investors, people who want to set up home and company in your city, that first impression is important. You get off the plane. How easy is it for you to imagine your life there? Well, if the first thing that happens is you sit in traffic, then it becomes less imaginable.
It is important, isn't it, Steve, that first impression? It can completely colour the way you see a city, especially if you've never visited before.
Completely. I was in Vienna last week, and you know, leaving the heart of Vienna to go back to the airport, it took me 20 minutes by train. And it was a breeze. And it was, you know,
that is laughter from me on behalf of all our listeners in Melbourne.
Well, indeed. Well, you know, and you see it here with London's airports. It's, you know, the Heathrow Express is pretty good, but it's hugely expensive and you know, puts you not in the easiest part of town. Gatwick is a nightmare. Stansted even worse. These things matter.
Steve Bloomfield, also Tyler Brulé and Andrew Tuck, thank you all very much for joining us at Midori House. That is all we have time for. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Helena Jarit. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. There's music next at 1900 hours. It's The Menu, I think I'm right in saying, with Marcus Hippie. And there's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday, 1800 London time, same time as usual. For now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.